Hello, this is Beth Ludwig from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the November issue of the Ladies' Home Journal. Our first article is called Living the Recession, Broken Dreams. The economy may be showing signs of recovery, but millions of middle-class Americans are still in serious financial trouble. Here, four families share the story of how the recession hit home and how they're struggling to put their lives back together. We went on food stamps. Andrew and Michelle Balzer knew their lives had changed when they heard the tow truck in their driveway at 2 a.m. last June. "They'd come to repossess our minivan," said Andrew, 45, who lives with his wife and four daughters in an upscale section of L.A.'s San Fernando Valley. "We asked the repo guy if we could at least get the girls' toys out first, and he said okay. But we were outside in our pajamas unloading the van, and I'm thinking, this can't be happening." Just last year, Andrew was pulling in a six-figure salary as a business manager at an IT staffing company. The holiday season was approaching, and things were looking good. He just won a major contract and was in the process of setting up new offices in Seattle. But despite that business, his company's revenue plummeted with the recession, and Andrew was laid off last November. He has since spent the family savings, stopped paying his $3,100 monthly mortgage, and is living on unemployment benefits of around $1,900 a month. "A friend suggested that I apply for food stamps," says Andrew, who is now receiving $293 a month in stamps for his family of six. "It's something that never even crossed my mind until she brought it up. I mean, why would it? I've never been in this position before." Now the Balzar's home of 10 years is dangerously close to foreclosure. Andrew says they are $40,000 behind in payments and that the mortgage company has been calling. He has no idea where they'll end up if they are forced out. "We had a lot of help from friends and my mom," he says, "but they can only do so much. The idea of losing our home is the scariest thing yet. I just really, really need to work, but there is nothing out there. Nothing." A business graduate from California State University, Andrew estimates he's applied for more than 60 jobs, and his wife is looking for part-time work. The four Balzar girls are aware the family's economic status has changed. They're adjusted to having one car, no cable, and eating in every night. But birthdays are hard. Their family tradition was to celebrate at Disneyland or Knott's Berry Farm. But now the kids take a rain check. They say, "We'll go when Daddy gets a job," says Andrew. But then the next question always is, "Daddy, when are you getting a job?" It can really drag your spirits down, especially coming from 5 to 7-year-olds. Andrew is currently making a small monthly commission selling organic beverages online. It's helpful, but not lucrative or stable enough for a family to live on. Everybody talks about the effects of the stimulus package and the fact that the stock market shows the economy is starting to recover, he says, but I don't see it from where I'm standing, no matter how hard I look. The next family, the story is called We Had to Move to a Motel. At first, Fred Scott's kids saw life in a motel as an adventure. The TV was right by the bed. Nearly everyone got to sleep in the same room, and those little bars of soap, downright exotic. Plus, with nowhere for their mom or dad to cook, Taco Bell and McDonald's became dinner staples. The little ones were pretty excited, says Fred, 34. But the older kids were hit with the reality pretty fast that we lost our apartment and we were basically homeless. Fred, his wife, Lisa, and their six young kids were evicted from their Huntington Beach, California apartment last year. It was the day after Mother's Day, and Fred had recently been laid off as a maintenance and repair engineer for a commercial dishwasher company. His pay of $55,000 a year had put them squarely in the middle class. They lived in a nice neighborhood near the beach where their kids, ranging in age from 2 to 11, attended local schools or stayed home with their full-time caregiver mom. After the eviction, we didn't have the money or credit for an apartment that would fit all of us, and our parents weren't in a situation where they could take us in, so we figured we'd tough it out at a cut-rate motel until things got better, said Fred. But once they checked in, two of the kids started having asthma attacks and severe outbreaks of eczema. Those places allow animals, and their kids have allergies, said Fred. Our poor boys were up all night scratching and wheezing. We saw doctors a couple of times a week. The Scotts decided to spend their dwindling savings on nicer accommodations, so they moved into a pricier motel and struck a weekly deal with the sympathetic manager. They financed their stay with Fred's new job as a cable TV installer. The money kept a three-star roof over their head until orders for cable dipped with the economy. The family briefly considered checking into a shelter. I didn't want to turn away help, but we have little kids, and we were worried about what kind of people might be there, said Fred's. Friends were saying, well, you gotta do what you gotta do. But for us, the kids' safety came first, no matter what. We just couldn't do it. After their truck was impounded, with the children's medication, clothing, and diapers in the back, the intensely private family began reaching out for help. They alerted their kid's principal, who helped keep their children on track in school, and gave the Scotts a list of resources that led them to the Orange County Rescue Mission. 1 year after they lost their apartment, the family moved into a four-bedroom flat. The security deposit was donated by the mission, which is now also helping Fred get an armed security guard license. If I hadn't found them, I hate to think what had happened to my family, said Fred, who is still without a car. It gives me hope that after everything, there's still a possibility we could turn things around. Our third family's article is called, We Have to Go Without Medical Care. 2 years ago, Keith and Cheryl Johnson's life in Fairmont, Maine, was as serene as the view over the town's boat-filled harbor. It was a nice life, said Cheryl, 52. Not a lot of worries. Keith, also 52, a trucker, and Cheryl, a real estate agent and appraiser, had a combined annual income of $76,000, enough for them to live in a nice neighborhood with good public schools for their 13-year-old daughter, Rachel. In June of 2000, the life they had built for themselves began to unravel. Keith ruptured several spinal discs in a work-related accident and could no longer sit for long drives. Then in March of 2009, his company downsized and he was laid off. His employer had provided the family's health insurance, and they were shocked to learn that it would cost $1,500 a month to buy COBRA coverage for all of them, a figure much more than their budget could absorb. There really was no choice, though. Keith needed insurance to pay for the back surgery he was scheduled for, as well as for his diabetes and hypertension medications. The family decided to continue insurance for $564 a month, but for him only. By this time, the real estate market had taken a hit, and Cheryl had less work and less income. What's more important, your health or food for your family? Keith asks in frustration about their impossible situation. With no insurance for her or her daughter, Cheryl was forced to forgo the anti-anxiety medication she had been on since Keith's accident and had to pray for Rachel's continued good health. Then came more bad news. Cheryl's job was being eliminated. On her last day of work, Cheryl felt something pop while she ate. 3 days later, her face was red and swollen, and her right eye drooped. At the emergency room, she was diagnosed with cellulitis, a bacterial infection that can be disabling or fatal if untreated. She was put on antibiotics and told to see a dental surgeon in 3 days. The infection cleared up quickly, but there was no money for the surgery. That reality, along with the bleak job outlook and their growing debt, prompted a decision the Johnsons had hoped to avoid. They left Maine and moved with Cheryl's widowed mother in Ohio. The move was supposed to make their lives less stressful by saving money, but it had the opposite effect on Keith, who worries about starting over with new doctors. He is hoping to settle a workers' compensation claim so he can be retrained in a field that doesn't require extended sitting. Cheryl's prospects look brighter. She heard that a local real estate appraiser might be hiring soon. On the job application, where it asked about which types of insurance might interest her, Cheryl checked every box: dental, vision, disability. "I don't care what's left over money-wise," she said. "I'm starved for coverage. If I could, I would stand on the highway with a sign that says, 'We'll work for insurance.'" Our final family story is called "The Military Was Our Best Option." Newlyweds Sarah and Travis Dubay don't need the Dow Jones for economic forecast. The couple, both 27, only need to look at their dwindling bank statement. 5 jobs between them lost in a year, more than 400 job applications, and barely a call for an interview, and now confronting a future that will require them to live thousands of miles apart. Just 18 months ago, the couple could hardly have imagined such a dramatic reversal of fortune. Sarah made $700 a week at an engineering firm working as a computer-aided drafter. Travis, a skilled blacksmith originally from the Michigan Rust Belt, had moved to coastal Calabash, North Carolina, with Sarah and had landed an assistant manager's job at a restaurant that paid $300 a week. Yes, it was less than he had previously earned in his trade, but he and Sarah were young and in love and had high hopes that he'd be able to do better eventually. They planned a June 2009 wedding, after which Travis was going to adopt 5-year-old Addison, Sarah's son from a previous relationship. "Life was good," Sarah said. When Sarah was laid off in June 2008, she didn't panic. Instead, she cobbled together part-time jobs and ultimately landed a position in the marketing department of a hotel where Travis was eventually hired. But then, he and Sarah were both laid off a week apart in October of 2008. As bills went unpaid, their worries mounted. "I was scared," Sarah says. "There was no light at the end of the tunnel." Travis was even harder hit. He felt he was failing his future family. A friend suggested he join the military. With the country at war, Travis knew he would most likely be deployed. But it was his only option, so he enlisted last November. He and Sarah got married before he left for basic training. This past July, the family moved to their first assignment in Colorado Springs. The immediate perks of Army life, including a housing allowance and family insurance coverage, have brought some relief. But Sarah worries about the money have been replaced by anxiety over Travis's first deployment, which could come at any time. "The separation is going to be hard," she says. "Travis is nervous about going to war, but he'd rather face combat than be unemployed and unable to provide for his family. In the year before joining, I spent 6 months looking for work. Now I have job security," he says. "Uncle Sam doesn't lay anyone off." Our next article are 6 steps you can take to reduce stress. So stress triggers could be sabotaging your efforts to stay calm. Avoid these common culprits. Step number 1, being negative. Let's face it, nobody likes a Debbie Downer, and negativity can be contagious. The good news? Happiness can be too. You're 15% more likely to be happy if you have a friend who's happy, according to a study in the British Medical Journal, and you can even catch the feel-good vibe from a friend of a friend. Step 2, obsessing over problems. Go ahead and debrief your girlfriends about that frustrating situation, your divorce, your husband's layoff, your mother's nagging. Just don't retell it more than 3 times, says Marcia Shamoff, author of Happy for No Reason. Saying that you're stressed over and over can reinforce the feeling and keep you stuck there. Step 3, lashing out. When you take your feelings out on those around you, it usually only leads to more stress. Try stepping into the other person's shoes or getting away from the situation until you feel calmer, says Alan Elkin, Ph.D., author of Stress Management for Dummies. If that doesn't work, channel your frustration into an activity like kickboxing. Step 4. Smoking. You may think that you're feeling calmer after a puff, but you're really just satisfying your nicotine craving. Philosophically, smoking actually stresses you out. Nicotine is a stimulant that increases your heartbeat and raises your blood pressure. Step 5. Taking yourself too seriously. Laugh at yourself. Sharpen your observation skills and find the humor in everyday events or surround yourself with images that make you laugh, like a funny screensaver. The final step, step 6, blowing stuff out of proportion. If you tend to overact, try this exercise. Ask yourself if you're going to still be bothered by the situation in 3 years, in 3 months, or even 3 minutes. Now, in the health section, we're going to have a pill alert. Despite the scary headlines, experts say acetaminophen, generally called Tylenol, is good for pain relief because, unlike aspirin, it has no stomach bleeding risk. Overstepping the recommended daily dose may harm your liver in a matter of days, though, so read labels carefully. Even if it's Pamprin, Theraflu, for example, they have acetaminophen in them. Take no more than 2,600 milligrams a day. What's in 5 extra strength, 500 milligram tablets, or 8 regular 325 milligram tablets, and never have more than 2 alcoholic drinks when taking acetaminophen. Here's some holiday diet do's and don'ts from the director of the Comprehensive Weight Control Program at New York Presbyterian Hospital. It's going to be broken down into the mistake, why it doesn't work, and what should you do. The first mistake, you skip breakfast and skimp on lunch to hoard calories for a big dinner. Why it doesn't work? Your appetite will surge by the end of the day, setting you up for a major pig out. The smarter strategy would be to eat a low-carb, high-protein breakfast and lunch to keep blood sugars even and hunger under control. The second mistake, you pass on the appetizers, but not the cocktail. Why it doesn't work? Drinking on an empty stomach stimulates your appetite and lowers your resolve to eat moderately. The smarter strategy, enjoy healthy hors d'oeuvres, raw veggies, a few shrimp, but skip the cocktail sauce, skip the cocktail, and have just one glass of wine at dinner. The mistake, you eat a light dinner so you can dig into dessert. Why it doesn't work? The heavy sugar and the starch hit from dessert brings blood sugar swings that can make you feel hungrier the next day. Smarter strategy, fill up on high protein fiber foods first so you'll be satisfied with a small portion of the sweet stuff. The last mistake, you avoid the scale because you feel guilty about splurging. Why it doesn't work? What you don't know about the pounds you're gaining can hurt you. Smarter strategy? Weigh yourself daily and nip any minor gains by eating smaller portions and stepping up your workout. I was killing myself. The View's Sherry Shepherd reveals the havoc diabetes had wreaked on her family and why she ignored her symptoms anyway. As an adult, I have been shocked to find that many people in the United States do not have a dining table large enough to accommodate a relative in a wheelchair. While growing up, I genuinely believed that what united us Americans was one-legged uncles. Amputation and blindness were unremarkable in my family. I knew that babies were supposed to be born with 10 toes, but it was news to me that they were supposed to keep them beyond the age of 50. I thought amputation was part of the aging process, not the result of diabetes, which is all over my family like whipped cream on pumpkin pie. Yet I was never made aware of the disease, or even told how to avoid it. Every once in a while, I would hear vague murmurings about the various family members. Did you hear about your uncle? He got the sugar. The sugar, of course, was diabetes. That's how common diabetes was in my family. We gave it a cute nickname, like it was the family dog. My grandfather, grandmother, and mother had the sugar, and my aunt, sister, and cousins live with the sugar. Of course, now I know that fatal hereditary diseases should not be nicknamed. Women whose families have a history of breast cancer do not call it the cancy. I can Monday morning quarterback my family's history and see that our tragic era was not taking diabetes seriously. And when it happened to me, I nearly made the same deadly mistake. My mom's diabetes was bad, and she didn't do much to treat it. Yes, she'd give herself shots and check her levels on insulin strips, but I always saw her drinking fruit punch and eating cookies. Doctors called diabetes the silent killer, which sounds a heck of a lot more serious than the sugar. The disease does internal damage first if you're not looking for the signs. The symptoms, numb feet, tingling fingers, blurred vision, came and go. Then they stayed for good. I didn't realize how bad my mom's health was until she started having complications. Lots of seemingly unrelated illnesses like stroke, kidney disease, and high blood pressure are actually complications of diabetes. In my mom's case, they seemed to come at once, like an avalanche. She lost the feeling in her feet, and her vision got worse. Her trips to the hospital came more frequent. The last time my mom was checked into the hospital, she had fallen into a diabetic coma, and the doctor told us her prognosis looked grim. "We need to amputate your mother's toe," he said. "Okay, it's just a toe," I said. "Well, no, that's the beginning. Her other toe is going to follow shortly thereafter. And then we're going to amputate the next one, and then it's going to be her whole foot. The amputation won't stop," he said. The hospital had put her on life support system. Our choice was to let her stay unconscious or a breathing machine while doctors began taking pieces off her body, or let her go. We knew she would not want to live like that, so my two sisters and I made the wrenching decision to take our mother off life support. She was 41 years old when she passed on. The sugar and its complications can take a person fast. When I was 23, I lost my mom. "Well, Sherry, I bet you took a good look at yourself in the mirror and changed your eating habits right then and there." No, I didn't. I did not give diabetes another serious thought until I saw a nutritionist a few years ago when I was around 38. I was hoping to learn about a diet plan that would kickstart my metabolism and help me lose weight. He took some tests and set me down. He said, "Sherry, you are pre-diabetic." "I'm diabetic?" I asked. "No, you're pre-diabetic. You're borderline. So I'm not actually diabetic. Not yet. So technically I can still eat pasta and cheesecake and stuff. He got frustrated. I don't know how I can make the situation more plain to you. This is very urgent. Your glucose level and your A1C result, the level where your blood is, are so high, you might as well be a diabetic. But I'm not? No, you're not. That's all I needed to know, and I didn't change a thing. I did notice little changes over the next year. My feet started to tingle, my toes would get numb. It bothered me enough to start praying. God, I can't feel my left toe. If you bless me that I don't have to get it cut off, I swear I won't eat another piece of chocolate. The feeling would come back to my toe, and an hour later, I'd be eating chocolate. One of the signs of diabetes is extreme thirst. You keep running to the bathroom to pee, but when you sit on the toilet, nothing. Once it started happening to me, I got scared. My youngest sister, Lori, was diagnosed with diabetes, and that's how it began with her. I knew. I made an appointment with the doctor. The first thing she did was measure my glucose. Okay, Sherry, it's really high. Let's do a test. The 4-hour glucose test. It's a classic. You eat a normal meal, then you don't have anything for 4 hours. Then you get tested. I must have sensed that the normal meal would be my last guilt-free binge because I went to a pancake house and ate and ate. I put strawberry syrup on everything, even my coffee. When the doctor returned with my results, she was frowning. Good news, I asked. I tried to savor this last second of normal life because I knew I had diabetes. I'd have to change everything. Sherry, your glucose level is 294, she said. A normal reading is 100. I tried to save myself. It's the syrup. Let's do another one tonight. No, Sherry, you're going on medication. Right now you're probably saying, so, Sherry, it sounds like you got scared straight and you got your stuff together. Stop right there. I didn't even bother to fill the prescription. Why? I can't stand to take pills. Lori had already begun a regimen of medications. She tells me she hasn't felt like herself since. Shortly after my diagnosis, I was sitting on the stairs. I had just eaten pasta with pesto, my favorite, and I make it from scratch. I could feel the pasta sinking its teeth into my blood. I was drained of all the energy I had left. I prayed. God, I said, I start The View this month, but I have no energy. My mind is foggy. What am I going to do? I had a vision, a real vision, like you read about in the Bible. The colors were real. I saw my son Jeffrey. He was 3 years old at the time, but in my vision, he was 5, curled up on his bed, clutching his teddy bear. He was crying. All the moms had come to school that day, except his. He was asking where heaven was, because that's where his mommy lived. I started crying. I didn't want my son to wonder where his mommy went, or have to decide to pull me off life support. I didn't want him growing up with a sick mom. Finally, I could hear what God was saying. Sherry, this could be your story, but it doesn't have to be. That was my scare straight moment. That day, I stopped eating pasta, soda, fruit punch, French fries, basically everything delicious. I started eating healthy, really healthy. I went from 187 pounds to 147 pounds, just as I was starting on The View. I began as a size 16 and went to a size 4, all on television. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of From Soups to Nuts. I had been reading from the Ladies Home Journal November issue. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope that you've enjoyed it. I'm Beth Ludwig, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. So long, until next time.